The other arguments the plaintiff made for altering the burden of proof. Again, the first argument about alternative liability didn't work because the plaintiff couldn't identify or couldn't name all of the defendants who might have caused the injury. But again, the plaintiff's not out of arrows here. What's the next argument that they use? Yeah, this is either concerted action or concert of action. What's the basic idea here? What kind of facts does the plaintiff have to present to qualify for this exception? Now, the court gives an example of a situation in which concerted action would apply.
It actually shows up in the footnote, I think.
I can't remember whether they describe it. No, that's the third one. Something about it's a case involving a drag race. I remember whether that So an example of concerted action. You may recall the scene in Meet the Parents, where is it Ben Stiller? Isn't he he's at the stoplight and motions to his prospective father-in-law to race. Okay, in a drag race, the plaintiff doesn't have to establish which defendant actually caused the injury. Both are liable for the injury because each, in effect, is the agent of the other. It's a kind of vicarious liability situation. So the key aspect of concerted action is some kind of common plan or agreement. How close can the plaintiff come, in this case, to establishing the existence of a common plan or agreement? Well, you mentioned the evidence before. What is the evidence? What does the plaintiff offer by way of evidence that there was a common plan or agreement? I thought you started said Ms. Keene.
They all use the same formula.
Yeah, they're all essentially doing the same thing. If all of you showed up one day wearing Hoop Fest t-shirts or something else, I would sort of assume that this was the fruit of some common agreement rather than, mere random chance that you're all doing the same thing. So the fact that each of them uses the same formula, relies on the same research, does that qualify for concerted action? What does the court say? There's identical behavior, but the fact that if you're driving on I-90 in the middle of the state, and everybody around you is going 75, 80 miles an hour, even though the posted speed limit is 70, you wouldn't necessarily assume that all those people were acting under a common plan or agreement. We didn't meet at a rest stop and say, let's all drive 15 miles an hour above the speed limit. We all found it to our advantage to do that, but it wasn't pursuant to some common plan or agreement. Again, if you're If you wake up one morning and you drive to your gas station to fill up your tank and discover that the price of gas is 20 cents higher than it was yesterday, and you say, well, I'll go to some other gas station, and lo and behold, all the gas stations in town have prices 20 cents above what they were yesterday, there may be a common plan or agreement, or it may be they're all reacting to the fact that some refinery in Montana blew up, and there will be a shortage of gasoline, and when you have a shortage of supply, typically results in a rise in prices. Again, the antitrust division may be very interested in whether these owners of the gas stations did meet for coffee and talk about, well, I think we could, you know, raise it 25 cents a gallon. If there were, they're in trouble with the law. But it could also be that they're simply acting out of the same set of incentives. You know, you all show up with laptops, or many of you show up with laptops. You have outlines in hand and so forth, not because you all agreed to do this, but because it's all to your mutual advantage to do so. So again, the essence of concerted action is essentially some kind of agreement. It doesn't have to be formalized. Ben Stiller can be, you know, raising his finger or whatever he does, motions to Robert De Niro to race to the next stoplight. That could be enough for the agreement, but even that is lacking in this case. So again, concerted action doesn't work. There's another arrow in the quiver here. What's that? Okay. And what's the basic concept there?
Everybody was doing it, and it was wrong, so everybody should pay for it.
That sounds sort of like the last one, though. Concerted action. What is the first of all, what's the example that they use, or the precedent? What previous case applied the doctrine of enterprise liability? Yes, and tell us the facts of that case. Okay. And after the blasting cap explodes, you have no way of identifying which manufacturer made the particular blasting cap that caused this injury. So the plaintiffs sue the manufacturers in the industry and said, in effect, we should be relieved of the burden of establishing which one caused our injury. And what is it that the plaintiffs are saying justifies this exception to the rule? What did the defendants do that makes it stops?
Didn't they all they went through a trade association, traded information, one of them was Research One, so they traded out
Is that a variation though of concert of action?
That's what I would think.
Well, then we wouldn't need a new theory. There's something different going on here that doesn't fit that. Ms. Russell? What was the industry-wide custom? Okay, but it's still sounding to me like they're all doing something together. I'll just end the suspense here. the difference is, you're very close to Ms. Russell, but it's actually concerted inaction is the way I would describe it. That is, they get together in this trade association, they talk about chemical formulas, they talk about how to promote, you know, how to get more people to buy the products that they sell. But what they don't talk about is how to keep little kids from getting their hands or their faces blown off. So where they had the opportunity within a small, you know, collection of in these trade association meetings, they had a golden opportunity to do something in the interest of safety, and they collectively sat on their hands. That collective inaction, and I'll use this with I'll put a concerted inaction here. Again, that's not an official term, but it may help you sort of realize this is in effect the equivalent of this, except it's in the form of a sin of omission rather than a sin of commission, but functionally equivalent. Now, can that theory be applied in Sindel? Why not? Okay, so the first problem, the first lack of analogy, again, one of the things about Sindel is it's a classic example of using precedent to say, hey, my case is like this other case, use the rule in that case and apply it here. Well, the defense to that is to say the cases are not analogous. They don't match up. This case is not on all fours with this previous case because there are crucial details that are dissimilar. And one of the details that's dissimilar is that instead of having a small group of manufacturers tightly linked in this trade association, you have this disparate, you know, hundreds of manufacturers spread out across the globe, and they don't meet regularly to discuss common concerns. There's another feature of this case that makes it dissimilar to Hall versus DuPont. In Hall versus DuPont, the manufacturers did have a significant amount of say about what went on. If they had adopted a common, you know, safety standard, you know, good safety practices for the labeling or storage or distribution of blasting caps, that could have worked. Here, on the other hand, why would, even if they had met in a room and had come up with ideas about how to test or manufacture DES? Ms. Green? Yeah, the FDA is the 600-pound gorilla in the room here. You can't try to do the job of the FDA. The blasting cap industry didn't have an FDA associated with it, and the manufacturers were free to run their business. If the manufacturers of DES had started functioning as a kind of mini FDA, the FDA itself would have said, we're in charge here, would have preempted it. So again, to the extent the plaintiff is blaming the defendants for failing to regulate or monitor the safety of these products, the defendants properly say, but that's the job of the FDA. And again, we get back to the question of how do we want the FDA's role in this to be harmonized with the expectations we have of the defendants. The defendants asked for our sympathy in terms of saying we have to serve two masters. You know, on the one hand, we're answerable to the FDA. On the other hand, we're answerable to a jury 10 years, 20 years hence, who scrutinize our research and marketing practices and impose a standard of, you know, of their own. So, have pity on us, drug manufacturers, for the tough situation we're put in. And again, it's sort of a political question, as there are lots of political questions about drug companies. What happens when a drug company comes up with a drug for the treatment of AIDS, let's say, and the drug is fabulously expensive? And the drug company says, yeah, we came up with this drug, and we put, you know, $300 million into research. And we're going to get that money and then some back, because for every product we produce with these great success stories, we've got a whole bunch of products we lose money on. So, the evil of free market. And other people would say, well, now, wait a minute. You're restricting the ability of people to get the drugs that might save their lives. How can you do that? So, again, the whole question about the role of the profits, the role of government regulation, whether we should be looking to the tort system or looking to a government agency as our primary protection against dangerous drugs, you know, it's very much a political question. All right, so we've struck out 1, 2, 3, but the plaintiff's not done. The plaintiff has a fourth argument here. Yes, the one that winds up persuading the court. What's the idea behind market share liability? Okay, it's kind of a modification of the rule in Summers versus Tice. Instead of looking to one manufacturer as being the one that is responsible, we say, in effect, why don't we proportionalize this and divide up, you know, in a sort of classic pie chart, here are the different market shares, Eli Lilly and Park Davis and Merck and all these different drug companies, Squibb, and each of them will be assessed, in effect, the relative market share for which they are responsible. And I may have raised this before, where did the court get this idea? Yeah, from some student comment in a law review article. Those of you who have, you know something about law review as a sort of a nice addition to your resume. Law review is a wonderful thing to do in law school. Students write notes, which are essentially the description or discussion of a case. So you take a prominent case like, you know, the Michigan affirmative action case, and you would discuss the case and the implications this case might have in the future. Or there are also case comments or student comments where you take an issue and then sort of a piece of advocacy. Here's a way in which the law should be changed or modified, or here's a better way to run the railroad. So some student at Fordham University, one of our sister Jesuit institutions in New York, wrote this article on how to handle the DES cases. And the California Supreme Court says, wow, this is a pretty good idea. I think we'll do this. And obviously the plaintiffs cited this article, brought it to the court's attention, but the court was persuaded that this was the right way to handle cases like this. Now, one of the problems that we've talked about is just the implementation of a rule like this. How do you go about ascertaining in a particular case, the one I gave, woman in Spokane, whose mother was taking a DES drug, the daughter now suffers from the symptoms of DES exposure, and we're trying to identify the market shares of these different defendants. And Squibb and Lilly and Park Davis and all these different manufacturers will have their own proposal for the best way to calculate market share. So, for example, if Squibb rarely sold to grocery stores or pharmacies located in grocery stores, their primary distribution was, you know, in some other method, or most of their customers were on the East Coast, or, you know, there's some other way to kind of say it wasn't me, or my share is lower, look to these other people, their share is higher. You could imagine that the determination of whether it's a a 3% market share or a 30% market share could be the subject of extensive factual inquiry, going through warehouses someplace that have the moldy old records of you know, prescriptions written 30 years ago, or, you know, trying to resurrect the spreadsheets and accounting records that might show where these products were purchased. Is that really a good use of our resources? On the other hand, if you're one of these companies and your share of this potential liability could be as little as 3% or as much as 30%, you care very desperately about how that number crunching is done. So on the one hand, the court has adopted this kind of elegant, creative solution to the problem, but by the same token, it's invited a whole new arena for dispute. And the court's majority opinion provokes a dissent from Justice Richardson. What's Justice Richardson's complaint in the dissenting opinion? Richardson compares the liability rule. Remember that going back to Hammondtree versus Jenner, there is this principle of applying strict liability to product manufacturers rather than limiting their liability to negligence. Richardson says, you know, that's a little bit of a walk on the wild side here, so that we hold people liable even though they've used reasonable care. But he says it's something else again to remove the requirement of causation. You're admitting, majority, that in many cases the product that injured the plaintiff was sold by none of the defendants. You're making the defendants pay for injuries which, at least in certain cases, they did not cause. How can that be fair? He asks. Now, the majority's answer to that, I think, would be, well, it's in part brought up in the next case in Brown versus Superior Court. What happens in Brown versus Superior Court is we get more specific about the mechanism of enforcement here. If we have the general concept of market share liability, how is that going to play out in terms of the specific application of the rule? So the plaintiffs would like, in effect, any defendant who's found to be liable for the whole thing. The principle we'll talk about later called joint and several liability. The defendants, on the other hand, make the argument for a more restricted form of liability. Even if you're going to use market share liability, it should be limited. And what does the court wind up saying in Brown versus Superior Court is the proper way to resolve that? Should each defendant be liable for the whole?
Plaintiffs should be required to join the actual manufacturers with them, that they could bear the entire, kind of go through the joint schedule situation, and from what I understood, they came to the reasoning that they shouldn't be required to bear the entire burden.
Right. In fact, the plaintiff, and the best analogy that I can use for this is like when you go to a restaurant and, you know, the server says to you, will this be one check or separate checks? Joint and several liability is a single check for the whole meal. And any diner can be presented with the bill and you got to pay the whole bill. And you can't say, well, look, I just had the cheeseburger and the Diet Coke. You know, the guy over here who had the steak and lobster and the expensive bottle of wine, that's his responsibility. Don't look to me. If it's a single check, you pay the whole thing. Whereas the court says in this particular situation, it's better, in effect, to have separate checks. You establish that Park Davis has a 3% market share. Park Davis should be limited to paying 3%, and the plaintiff, by analogy the server, has to chase down each individual, and if that individual can't be found or can't pay their fair share, tough luck for the server or the plaintiff. Now, depending on the circumstances, as we'll see in Chapter 6, a large part of Chapter 6 is devoted to this very issue. When do we want to make the defendants jointly liable, and when do we want to allow the defendants to limit their liability to their individual share of the action? In this case, the court says it wants to limit the liability to the individual share of the action, and what's the policy rationale for that? Why is that such a good idea in this case? Ortiz? The court's saying, in effect, to the plaintiff, look, we gave you the last one. This is sort of like a makeup call in basketball or something. The court giveth and the court taketh away. Blessed be the name of the court. The plaintiff got this dispensation. Remember Justice Richardson complaining, wow, we're really taking a walk on the wild side. Now, it's sort of the defendant's turn. The plaintiff is going to be limited to what they can establish by way of the market shares of each individual defendant. Again, it emphasizes the importance. Now we're going to be fighting tooth and nail over these market share determinations, because that's going to determine how much, if I can persuade the court that I only sold to freestanding drugstores and not to grocery stores that had a pharmacy in them, then I should be entitled to be dismissed from the action. If the evidence is that the plaintiff in a particular case got their prescription filled at a grocery store. Now, again, this sort of raises the larger question that we keep pondering throughout this course, of what the tort system is good for or what it's not good for. That as you contemplate cases like the asbestos cases, in which the expense of processing the case means that of every dollar spent on these cases, 17 cents winds up in the plaintiff's pocket and the rest goes to people like us, you can legitimately ask the question, is there a better way to handle cases like this? Maybe the tort system works fine for a fender bender that's over on I-90, but it doesn't work very well for DES cases or for asbestos cases or for other kinds of these very complicated toxic tort exposure, lots of scientific evidence, lots of room to just keep arguing over every little point. And again, one of the great attractions of the American legal system is, with respect to a particular issue, we have the world's most impressive set of procedures, and I think you can make the case that there is nothing finer than a well-tried case in the American legal system. We are second to none in terms of the quality of all the things that we offer. But it's as though we said to everybody, the only kind of car you can have is a high-end Mercedes. We won't allow people to drive around in their Datsuns and or Nissans and Ford Focuses, because we consider those to be inadequate compared to the beauty and sophistication of a Lexus or a Mercedes. Well, that's all very well and good if everybody could afford a Lexus or a Mercedes, but many of us can't. And if our only choice is to buy a high-end car or no car at all, and we're told, if our only option is to buy a low-end car or none at all, and we're told, in fact, no, you can't have that, then what kind of a fix are we going to be in? So again, I think the criticism, or at least the place to ponder about the effect of the legal system is, as we keep pursuing this ideal of sort of justice without regard to, well, what does it cost to obtain this justice, we may be sort of pricing ourselves out of the market. And in the end, people don't feel, gee, we've got the finest legal system on the face of the earth. We have, as they say, the best legal system money can buy. The operative part of that being that money has to buy it, and if you don't have the money or can't afford it, if your dispute over a fender bender or over something else, if the cost of pursuing that is so high that you essentially get no remedy, you're a landlord, you have, you know, you borrowed some money to buy this, you know, two-bedroom house that you rent out, and you've got some tenants in there, and the tenants have trashed the place, and you're trying to kick them out, but you got to go hire a lawyer, and then there's that guy from Legal Aid who's there defending the tenant, and now it's going to cost me all this. You know, at some point you say, wait a minute, this system has become dysfunctional. I want my legal remedies, and I don't want them to be so expensive. So, again, as you look at a case like Sindel, one of the things that you're impressed with is, wow, this is really sophisticated stuff. And at the same time, you should be thinking to yourself, yeah, and what does it all cost? Can plaintiffs afford to do this? Would it be better for all concerned that, and I think there already is, I saw something flash on the news about an asbestos fund that was set up, again, and I think in part in response to the difficulties with the asbestos cases, some kind of system of compensation that bypassed the tort system. And again, the trial lawyers point out that all of these systems have terrible procedural flaws, and that you have the potential for people not to get what they deserve. But again, the question is, at what price? So, again, just sort of issues to ponder. For purposes of our case here, again, what we want to be looking at is the potential for the plaintiff to avoid the traditional but-for cause test. This only comes into play where the plaintiff has some difficulty meeting the traditional but-for cause test. In this instance, the problem the plaintiff has is with identifying who caused the injury. Such a problem doesn't arise if you're hit by somebody running a red light. There's no need for exceptions to the rule. If the doctor allegedly failed to properly diagnose your condition, again, you don't have any problem such as the one here. But where you do have this kind of a problem, somebody caused my injury, but it could be one of a number of different defendants. I'm having difficulty pinpointing which one caused my injury. Then you want to be able to pull out these different theories and say, well, can I meet the alternative liability standard? Can I meet the concert of action standard? Can I meet the enterprise liability standard? Can I meet the market share liability standard? Questions about this, these distinctions and how they work together, et cetera, before we... For the last case in this section, Edwards versus A.L. Lease and Company, I want to cover that before we quit for the day. But, Mr. Bradford.
I have a question. In these cases, when you look at applying these types of
good question. And what we have, Sindel is a good example of how it's likely to come up. That is, in Sindel, the plaintiff, it's actually a class action. We haven't talked about class actions. It's something you'll cover in civil procedure, how you can get a group of plaintiffs essentially pursuing their claims through a kind of sampling process rather than individual determination. But for our purposes, it might just as well be an individual action of Judith Sindel. She files her complaint, and the defendants respond by saying, even assuming for purposes of discussion that you could prove we were negligent, we realize that issue is one that a jury would have to decide. The defendants say the plaintiff's claim fails because she can't prove causation. So they sort of hold the negligence issue off for a moment to say we can get rid of this case based on the failure of the plaintiff to prove the causation element. And the trial court starts out agreeing with the defendants, saying, in effect, you apparently don't know who caused your injury. If you can't identify the person who caused your injury, you can't proceed, even assuming there was negligence. So, you know, it's sort of like saying without tires on your car, you may have a perfectly good engine, but if you don't have any tires on your car, it's not going anywhere. Now, later on, we come back because the trial court dismisses the case based upon failure to establish causation. The Supreme Court says, we'll reinstate the case because we've got a way for her to establish an exception to causation. Using this market share liability, it's kind of a workaround for the inability to identify which defendant caused her injury. Then the case goes further on the issue of liability. What is the liability standard? And that's the one we pick up again in Chapter 9. How do we know that the defendants were negligent or that they're subject to strict liability, that the product was defective? Whatever is essentially the Chapter 1 kind of issue about whether there was negligence or some other kind of breach of duty. Now, for exam purposes, not that that's our sole preoccupation, but it's an important one. For exam purposes, you will frequently get a problem, a fact pattern, in which both issues, in fact, perhaps all three issues, breach of duty, causation, and damages, are in play. So you would have to evaluate each part of the plaintiff's case, and typically I give you a fact pattern in which there is some uncertainty with respect to at least, you know, two out of those three, if not all three. So instead of being able to say, well, no, causation is missing here, case is over, I don't even have to talk about strict liability or negligence, those won't even come into play because the defendant's going to win the causation issue, I won't make it that easy for you. I will give you something that creates difficulty that requires you to evaluate. For example, it wouldn't be a case like this on this semester because it involves product liability, which is next semester, but you can easily get a problem that revolved around, was the defendant negligent? And so you'd have to, or should the defendant be held strictly liable? And you'd have to pull out all your tools to work on that and say, here's my assessment of the Chapter 1 issues. At the same time, I recognize that even if the plaintiff could meet the test for establishing negligence or strict liability, there is a significant causation issue. Either there's a problem establishing but-for cause, as in cases like this, or there's a problem with legal cause. It may have been a but-for cause of the issue, but the defendant's got a very good case that it's not a legal cause of the injury. And on top of that, this is why the midterm is a level of magnitude of difficulty greater. On top of that, there are these damages issues. I don't know if this person qualifies for a damage award. Or I don't know how this wrongful death statute would be interpreted as to whether this person would or wouldn't be entitled to recovery. So as you look at the midterm exams, they will address liability or, you know, breach of duty questions, address the proximate cause issues that seem to be in play, and discuss the damages issues that are in play. The good news, though, is that I give you 3 hours to do it.
Just one situation?
No, there are two questions on the midterm. And if you haven't done so already, you should take a look at the midterm exams and sample answers to get a feel for, okay, this is the way to handle a problem like this. And it's only more of the same with respect to the exam that you had yesterday. You're essentially, you know, throwing the ball up in the air, picking up the jack, catching the ball again. Throwing the ball up in the air, this time I get two jacks. Do kids still play? I don't know. Still play with the jacks anymore. I date myself here. But, you know, or juggling, you know, I can throw the ball up in the air and I can catch it. And then when I have two balls in the air, it's a little more challenging. And the problem as you get to the midterm is it's doing the same thing, only now I have to juggle these competing issues here. And as I think I said the other day, the problem is prioritizing them. I have to identify what are the things that need to be addressed first because they're the most important and they deserve, you know, quality time. There's some other things which if I had time I'll get into, but I'll put those on the back burner pending my ability to get where I need to go with respect to the things that will drive the action to a greater extent than this peripheral stuff. So, again, the challenge on the midterm is not just, you know, can I remember the substantive rules, the difference between concert of action and enterprise liability, can I correctly state the rule for but-for causation, that is, whether or not more probably than not this is a cause without which the injury would not have occurred, but it's also a question, can I pull out of this fact pattern the issues that deserve sustained attention, and can I essentially skip over the red herrings that aren't going to make a difference here so that my client will have the best information about what is coming down the pipe. Questions, again, I didn't mean to turn it just to sort of exam strategy, but again, as you're going through these cases, picking out the rules and seeing the way it works and getting this down, I would strongly encourage you to keep applying it to the task that will be the basis for evaluation in 2 weeks from yesterday, which is, you know, can I put this package together as I operate under time constraints? Why don't we pick up the lease case tomorrow, and it won't take us long, and then we'll move on to the other exceptions to but-for cause. Thank you.